Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month, and also my little scratchy voice. The show is also rebroadcast at 8 a.m. on the third Monday of each month, and you can stream this show and every KRFY show at krfy.org from anywhere in the world. If you like podcasts, you can listen to a podcast of the show at krfy.org and select podcasts. The monthly topics we discuss here will feature the medical designations for each month. Since this is November, I am focusing on adoptions. My guest is Katie Elsesser, who has two adopted children and is an attorney who helps families with the process of adoption. Welcome, Katie. I'm thrilled to have you here at our show today.
Happy to be here.
Susie Prez from our KRFY morning show and my executive producer is here with me as she enables KRFY to offer these discussions. Hi, Susie, and thank you for being here with me.
Well, good morning. Thanks for doing this show. Medical Musing provides the KRFY listeners interesting and informative interviews on a variety of medical and health-related subjects. I wanted to let the listeners know a little bit about who Dr. Joanne is. Dr. Joanne Royans is a longtime KRFY volunteer, previously broadcasting segments of Otto's Eclectic Mix, and is now hosting this show, Medical Musing, on the first and third Monday of the month at 8 a.m. Dr. Joanne is a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010. She previously worked in a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics. As the media spokesperson for the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, she contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. She's the mother of four adult children. We are fortunate to have this show, Medical Musing, as part of our Monday morning programming.
Thank you, Susie. I'm just going to give a little history of National Adoption Month first and adoption in general. The purpose of National Adoption Month is not only to increase awareness of the process of adoptions, but also to honor families with adopted children. It was in 1976 that Governor Michael Dukakis in Massachusetts proclaimed a week in November as National Adoption Week. This designation was applied to the entire U.S. by Gerald Ford in 1984 and changed to Adoption Month by President Bill Clinton. November 9th is World Adoption Day, and November 20th marks National Adoption Day, when thousands of adoptions are finalized by the following Saturday. Interestingly, it was Massachusetts that enacted the first Adoption of Children Act way back in 1851. It took until 1948 for the first cross-racial adoption to occur in the state of Minnesota, where a black child was adopted by white parents. In June of 2017, adoption by same-sex couples was legalized in all 50 states. This is a very appropriate month because we believe that all children deserve a safe environment, and that is why adoption is so very important. Adoption fits very well with both pro-life and pro-choice agendas. Any woman or girl who is unsure whether she can take care of a child needs to know that there are many loving families available to raise their child. It's so very important to find safe, secure homes and emotional support for these children and their parents. I did a little research, and there are 150,000 adoptions yearly, with a third coming from the foster care system. The United States has the most agencies, both public and private, local, private attorneys. The adoption world has changed so very much over the last century. I can remember, and I imagine Susie can remember, homes for unwed mothers, orphanages where the care wasn't always so good, and closed adoptions that were so prevalent in the 1900s. Now, obstetric providers, state agencies, and private attorneys, public attorneys, foster care placements, and open adoptions have become more prevalent. So, Katie, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, my name is Katie Elsesser, and I'm from Priest River, Idaho. I was actually born at Bonner General Hospital, and aside from when I lived in Moscow for attending University of Idaho for undergrad and law school, I've always lived in Bonner County. I've been in the practice of law for 11 years this year and have been doing adoptions from the beginning. I also am the adoptive mother of an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old, and actually we did complete our adoption on November 20th in 2015.
Wow. So that part of my research hit the nail on the head, so to speak. So describe the adoption portion of your legal practice. I know there aren't a ton up here in North Idaho, but what is the role of an attorney in the adoption process?
So there's a couple different areas that I practice, and one would be if a child is in foster care, after being in care for 15 out of 22 months, unless there's been significant progress by the parents, by federal mandate, they're supposed to start the termination of parental rights. Upon that being completed, the adoptive placement, so it's often the foster family, but it's not always, the adoptive placement will get permission to start the process for completing the adoption. Once the child has lived with that adoptive family for 6 months, they can file the petition to complete the adoption. So I do a lot of those for the local area. So anyone that is a foster to adopt out of the state system. And my role in that is just walking them through the paperwork and doing everything necessary to finalize the adoption and get the new birth certificates issued.
That's really interesting. So the children here in Idaho who are in foster care don't stay like, you know, forever, basically, unless the foster parent decides. Can they decide to be the adoptive, or they have to then?
Yeah, typically, it really depends on the scenario. To bring my personal experience, my kids were still in a placement at Kinderhaven, so they didn't have a foster parent. So at that point, they moved in with us as the foster placement after the termination. But in most cases, the current foster placement, if they've expressed an interest in adopting the child. So mm-hmm. Some people just do foster care and they only want to be foster placements. Sometimes they start that way and change their mind because they get attached to the children. So they typically are the priority placement. But there are situations where the foster parent either isn't in the position or not going to, in which case then they look for a adoptive placement. Mm-hmm. So it kind of just depends on each individual kid's scenario.
So the foster parents know that they're only going to have this child, and it can be from a newborn up to it through teenagehood, mm-hmm. that they're probably only going to have the child for a year or up to the 18 months. Is that?
Well, that's just when the court has to start the process of termination.
Okay.
So the goal, the federal mandate for the Child Protection Act is encouraging permanency. And so if a kid has been in care for 15 of the last 22 months and the parents aren't making progress, it's time to find them a permanent option. Children need permanency for so many reasons. And at that point, if the parents aren't working the case plan, then it's time for the state, the social worker, and the prosecutor to file that termination petition and look for a permanent option. Sometimes it's adoption. Sometimes it's guardianship for older children because some of the older children don't want to be adopted. But either way, they need permanency, and they can't just keep sitting in limbo while their parents don't work their case plan.
Okay. That's so, you know, very interesting, basically, because the foster system, a lot of us don't really know the whole, you know, mechanism of the foster system. And when I covered here for Sandpoint Peds, the pediatrician here, Joyce Gilbert, was very, very much involved with the foster care system. And I was telling Susie when I first got here that the nurse at Sandpoint Peds said to me, do you do shelters? It's like, what? And the shelter was the first exam when a child is placed in the foster family. So obviously then I didn't know really how long they stay with that family other than then we would see the older children of someone who's given up, but they want the child back. Mm-hmm. And then you investigate, and they're still doing drugs, or they're, that's how the newborns were placed. If the newborns are tested in the newborn nursery, then they immediately go to a foster family. And so I would see little babies at 2 or 3 days old that came in with a foster mom. Mm-hmm. Susie, do you have any comments or questions?
Well, you may have covered this, but one thing that came to my mind was there's foster to adoption, and then there's birth to adoption.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, is that the basic scenarios that you see? There is direct birth to adoption.
Yep. So part of my, when we were started on my practice, that is the majority of adoptions are my foster care ones. However, we do private adoptions as well. I don't arrange them, but however they come to be, if a birth mom and an adoptive mom want to complete an adoption, we can go through that process. I don't act like a facilitator, but I work through the legal paperwork that's required. There are obviously some actual centers that are designed for that.
Kind of agencies.
There could be agencies, and some of them are regional, and there are also people that place across state lines, but that's another element. Also, I finalize foreign adoptions. So certain countries don't finalize adoptions. They basically issue a guardianship, and then they expect the adoption to be completed within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know all the countries that require that. The one I did was Uganda. So that was one where they got the guardianship issued at the country level, and they got an immigration visa. And then in Idaho, we finalized with the actual placement. And then the third one that's more, or I guess fourth one, however you want to get it, the more common also is step-parent adoption. So if mom has a significant other who has basically been in that role of dad, and it could go the other way too, mom or dad, basically they terminate the biological parent that's not involved, and then the step-parent adopts.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, there's adult adoption. So sometimes you have a kid that wants to be adopted by a family member, but they don't want to deal with the fight of a biological parent. And so if they wait till they turn 18, you don't actually have to give notice to the biological parent. And so if a child was raised by a family member and they want to make that a permanent thing, they can do an adult adoption. There's no home study required for that. That's just a placement. So I've done those as well.
And in that case, it would be because the birth parent that doesn't want to let go and let them be adopted by the step in the home step parent is then out of the scene by the time they're 18, they have a choice.
Correct. Yeah. And so that, and it also can complete a name change at the same time if they want.
And children, the states may vary, but children do age out of foster care. I think you answered one of my questions that I'd written down. Are adoptions here more commonly via the foster care system? And I think really you said yes.
I think so. I think for the most part, I know that there are supportive agencies around, but it seems more common that unfortunately they have to go through the foster system, which is a lot of trauma for children to get to that point. But that is common, as well as I do think there are people that do foreign-born adoptions. I just may not encounter them because a lot of countries do allow you to complete the adoption process in their country.
Yeah.
So there's only certain countries that require it to come back here.
We had a lot in Columbia where worked in Columbus, Ohio. But let's go on and talk about your adopted children. How did you, get them and basically your experience as an adoptive parent?
So going back to growing up, I actually read a lot of books that involve foster care. And so even as a child, I always thought I'd wanted to adopt children out of foster care rather than have my own biological children. And I'm with the same guy that I started dating in high school. And he knew my plan, and he was on board. So after I finished law school and everything, we did the foster care licensing. And we told them we wanted elementary age kids, siblings. That was what we were looking to have in our home. Of course, you get the calls for newborns.
Mm-hmm.
You get the calls. We did have one foster live with us that she was a teen mom. But that was a short-term placement just because we were available. And then I won't get into details, but I actually had some headbutting with the department on my legal practice. So when they called about our kids that they wanted us to meet, they were living at Kinderhaven at the time. And we went and met them, and it was just like that, just a connection. We walked out, and my husband's like, those are our kids.
Oh, very cool.
And they are great kids. They are biological siblings. They were 7 and 8 at the time, but my daughter was just about to turn 9. So she turned 9 before they moved in with us. And then we met them in January, and they moved in with us end of February of 2015. And then we finalized the adoption in November of 2015.
That's just wonderful. And did they have any acclimation problems or...
Yeah, I mean, you know, my kids are pretty private, so and because of such a small county, yeah. I don't want to go too much into it. But I will tell you, I mean, there's adjustments, there's things that go on, and you know, they're also siblings that have been raised together, so you got the sibling dynamic of, you know, attention on this or that. But overall, I mean, it went pretty well, and like I said, they were moving from a group home and not a foster placement. I think it's harder for kids that get established in a routine of a foster placement. They wanted to leave kindergarten. There's things they loved about it, but they wanted a home. And they wanted, the thing about foster care, it's gotten better from when my kids were placed there, but there was a lot of restrictions. They now have this reasonable, prudent parent standard. But I mean, trampoline, not allowed at the time. I mean, there was all these things. So like they couldn't do certain things that normal kids their age could do because it was a safety concern for the state to have them be able to do it. And so it was very limiting, like sleepovers at friends' house, things like that. And so that was something they looked forward to, and they were very excited. And it's great. They're great. My daughter's off at college now, so playing volleyball.
That's wonderful. So. Yeah, it would be if you were in Kinderhaven and then you go to the Sandpoint schools, it would be, you know, very strange not to be inviting your friends back to a home and things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Adoption is such a general term, we talked about, because it can involve children of all different ages, from the newborn that I talked about that was, you know, right into foster care mm-hmm. immediately, or the newborn whose birth mom has decided prior to delivery that she desires to have her newborn opted out, to those teenagers or the elementary school, you know, children that you talked about. Anything else you want to add, Susie, right now?
Well, I hope eventually we'll kind of come around. Everything I'm hearing is for the health of the child. Mm-hmm. And this is a medical show, but health is not just physical health, but emotional and all of that. And when you, Katie, when you're talking about your children and the first time you met them, I think of the word kinship. Mm-hmm. Family is family, and sometimes it's not biological. Yeah. And so when parents, for the health of the child, when those homes are found that it's a good placement. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing. I'm sure you've seen a lot of that.
Yeah, those are my favorite days in court, our adoption days. I mean, everyone's just so excited to be there. And they're sealed proceedings, so the only people entitled to be there are the petitioners and the kids, but the courts let you bring whoever. And there's times we've had whole courtrooms just filled with supportive people, you know, and it's great. Everyone's happy, and the kids get a stuffed animal in Bonner County.
That is amazing. When a pregnant person, and I say pregnant person, it was so hard to write this because it was like, is it a teen? Is it a child? Is it a woman? So I'm calling it pregnant person, which is sort of a weird term, I guess, but decides she wants to place her newborn for adoption. It's so important to work with a caring obstetrician in conjunction, as Susie said, with a mental health counselor. If you were in Ohio, which is what I'm used to, a pregnant gal can decide, or would either be with a private practitioner, obstetrician, or a clinic, you know, OB for her prenatal care. And then it seems like, and I don't want to make huge comparisons, but then there's some counseling and deciding what you want to do, and then you find the attorney. So here it seems like people find each other almost some other way, or we don't, you know, basically... And then the parents also who want to adopt put together this profile so the female can review. We had a neighbor, a friend of my daughter's, who, you know, again, had tried in vitro X number of times and didn't succeed. And then they got an adopted child. And they had all this pre-birth, which is so unusual when you come from a world of closed adoptions, that they actually, the pregnant gal came to their house and they met them and talked to them and actually had her over several times. So again, the parent has to decide, the birth mom has to decide if they want it closed or open. I've been in delivery rooms that I know adoptive parents have either been in delivery rooms, or at least I've been called to see the baby as their private practitioner, as opposed to another doctor in the hospital seeing the newborn, and then coming to our practice for their first visit. So there's such a variety in all of it, but the psychological is really...
Well, and I would note, too, you know, I don't think there's as many agencies up here, at least in Northern Idaho, but a lot of people work with other agencies because they don't always want their child placed within here. Now, interesting tidbit I actually didn't tell you is the children's older siblings, one of them did place one of her children for adoption, which was the move. She wasn't in a place at that time, and they have open arrangement, but the couple actually was in Pennsylvania while she lived here in Idaho. So there some agencies, they work across state lines and everything like that, and... I just don't know of as many up here as there used to be, and mm-hmm. other states have a lot more, I think, services.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes the birth mom decides even if she wants to see or hold the baby, which mm-hmm. is always kind of shocking to those of us who hear it, because mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't, and sometimes that's where the hospital doctor sees them, and then the attorney later brings the child to the family. The pediatrician, like I said, we occasionally came and see the baby, and sometimes we would not. The finalization of the adoption, is that about 6 months, too, because that's what it is in
Ohio? No, in foster care, that has to do with the foster care. So actually, adoptions are a little bit different. When you do a private adoption, it kind of depends on your home study. You're supposed to have your home study done ahead of time, which is basically a pre-adoptive placement. And then they do a post-adoptive review, not post-adoptive, but a post-placement review to make sure everything's working good before you file the petition. And so, it's a little bit different depending on the situation. The 6 month has to do from foster care. Now in Idaho, to finalize adoption, you do have to be a resident of Idaho and lived in this county for 6 months. So if you were from another state trying to adopt an Idaho child, it's a little bit different because you can't file the petition here. So the petition, it depends. We do, when we are in charge with terminating parental rights, we do have to have at least 30-day notice to parents. And then also there's now this limbo. So it used to be, you would do a termination of parental rights. I call them a TPR, so if I throw that out there, just trying to...
Yeah, no, that's fine. You told me what TPR means, I'm fine with it.
And we used to do the TPR, and then we would immediately do the adoption. The Idaho Supreme Court had a decision that came down and requires a 14-day immediate appeal to the Supreme Court. So the TPR and the adoption hearing now have to be at least 14 days apart. So at the TPR, if the court grants it, they grant guardianship to the adoptive petitioner, but the adoption's now at least 2 weeks, and if a parent decides to withdraw their consent or if they didn't appear at the hearing but they want to appeal it, they have 14 days, and it's a direct appeal to the Idaho Supreme Court. Okay. So the time period's a little different. On our foster care, if they've already had the 6 months of placement, it's basically 30 days the department needs to get the final consent from their agency. So it can be a lot faster. It just depends. And sometimes if we can't find a birth parent that's on like a birth certificate, not a putative father, we have to publish notice in a newspaper that's likely to reach them. Because if we can't personally serve them notice, we have to give them some notice that their parental rights are being terminated. Mm-hmm. So this is if they've established some relationship with a child or married with the mother at the time or on the birth certificate. So then we actually have to go through the steps to try and give them as much notice, and so that can delay the process a little bit.
Wow. And again, TPR is termination of parental right.
Yeah. It seems that it's that 14 days is a smart move. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I think about the birth mother, if she is getting counseling and support, so that it's a difficult process.
Oh, sorry to cut you off, but I will note one thing that Idaho does. You don't sign a consent at the hospital. You have to go in front of a judge And the judge asks a lot of questions to make sure you've thought this through and why it's in the best interest of the child. So it's not a signature. They don't have to have the whole group there. They can do it one-on-one or with an attorney. But the court will walk them through, and the judges actually have like a set list of questions or that are recommended they ask, making sure they understand it, that they've had adequate time, they didn't have any pressure, no one made any promises. And so before they even get to that consent part, there's a lot of questions, and then they then also will have that 14 days. The 14 days is less likely to happen from someone who voluntarily consent. It's more as if someone who it was terminated against them and they thought it shouldn't have been. But it is that grace period for them to appeal it. But typically it wouldn't be for someone who consented, because most of our judges that I've experienced, they really make sure the person understands the permanency of what they're doing.
Interesting. Again, I'm thinking back to my experience here and wondering, do you see a lot of children who had methadone, you know, addicted parents? There used to be the billboards all over, and it doesn't seem to be quite as prominent. Cocaine, heroin, abuse of the mother, physical abuse. Are there common threads to the children that you see in foster care or who are
drug
coming
use,
out of foster care?
I would say drug use is a high one. You know, there's a lot of poverty that goes along with what raises concerns, but just because you may not live in the most typical housing situation or you may not have the most stable of occupations, it doesn't mean that your child's going to be removed. It's when there's neglect and abuse, but typically that does stem from either severe mental health problems, drugs, or a combination of the both of those.
So that's why it's so important, both medically, to get the child out of the home for their safety and their psychological status, and it's also important just basically for safety of the child. Let's talk a little bit about, you brought up a little bit the putative father comment. So there are so many different ways to father a child, I guess, or situations in which people father children. That might be the better way to say it. So either married or partnered, or the father can be acknowledged or educated. That's a big word, or putative. So can you tell us a little bit about all those different terms, or maybe not all of them, but
most common. Yeah, so when you're required to notice, to give notice or to obtain consent, it comes down to the situation with the father. So if mom puts father on the birth certificate, he is presumed to be the father, even if biological testing hasn't happened, and he has a right to have notice, and you have to specifically terminate his rights. If he was married to the mother at the time of the birth, or living with the mother and called himself the father. Putative father is basically, there's a registry in Idaho. So if you know there's a chance you may have fathered a child and you want your rights protected, you put yourself on the registry. And then I, as the adoptive, the representing the adoptive parents, I do a putative father search. And if nothing comes back, then we terminate on an unknown father. So it depends on the situation. Some people know who the dad is, the dad's on board with the adoption, and you just do both of their consents. But a putative father is basically, in a way, an unknown father who has to take steps to protect his rights.
Interesting. The next area that you brought up that I thought was really, really interesting was the name change. That, you know, how children would really want to keep their name, or, you know, how they feel about people changing their first name.
Yeah. So, you know, a part of the adoption process always includes a name change, but it's not required. So there's a lot of people who've lived in that and they want to keep their name, their full name, and that's always a choice. But what I've found is that we've had some disruptive, well, they're not just considered disrupted because they have happened after the adoption, but basically a adoption that fails. And the one, it's not, I'm not giving out research here, but it is curious that almost every one of them, there was a forced name change of their whole name, not just the last name. So these are kids who are, they can be from 6, 12, 13, older, and their adoptive parents say they want a clean break, you know, a clean identity, whatever they want to call it. But then they end up basically forcing a full name change. And every one of these failed placements or failed adoptions, the first thing when we do a new adoption, or even if we don't do a new adoption, if they're going to do guardianship, is they want a name change. So we will file a name change while they're still a minor, and they all want to go back to their biological name. So it's always an interesting choice. Now, when I do adoptions, if they're 12 and older, they have to consent to the adoption. So you can't force a kid older than the age of 12 to consent. Mm-hmm. But you always make sure that's the name they want. You go over it that they want. A lot of times, maybe they pick a middle name that means something to their new adoptive family, and they take the adoptive family last name. But I've rarely seen a first name change except for to go back to it. So there's been adoptions where they take the new adoption last name, but they went back to their birth name. So they're basically their second adoption. And I think there's a lot of identity that people struggle with adoption, and their mental health is like, what does it mean to be adopted? You know, why wasn't I, you know, some people, it's why wasn't I good enough for my parents to keep me, or whatever the case may be. And there's a lot of identity, especially if they're older when they're adopted. And it's very interesting to take that name away from them. And then it's almost like a divide from the beginning. So I think there's a lot that goes into it. And I think people going into it should be cautious that the name change is something that truly stems from them. So in my children's case, they both elected to take their biological last name as their middle name and get rid of my daughter kept her middle name and added it. My son got rid of his middle name and added his biological name to his middle. And that was their choice. I mean, they were old enough that they could understand the complexity of it, but they had the choice in it. And I'm also glad they didn't change their first name, because that would have been hard. I mean, they were, you know, 7 and 9. Yeah. And if they had asked me, they'd have to have had a really good reason for me to say, why do you want to change this? They weren't given like weird names. You know, you do see people that have names they're going to have to explain to people the rest of their lives. Yeah. So is it
the child that, no, the child doesn't want to change their first name. That just seems so odd to me. Majority of time, mm-hmm. they want to keep their first name, and that's what really bothers them.
When I've seen the failed adoptions, that's a huge issue. It's basically they took away their identity, like their first half of their life or part of their life didn't matter. You know, it's like it's the adoptive parents call it like a fresh start. Yeah. But it does seem to be taking away part of their identity.
Definitely.
And I don't encourage it, but I haven't had clients that have come to ask me to do that. So
wow. That'd be like adopting a dog. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, sometimes you change their name and sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
It may be for a lot of different reasons, but it does have a element of questionable element to it.
Yeah. It's just one of those hard things, because they're going to struggle with identity anyways. And knowing that they're adopted and all of that. And so it just seems weird to take it. Now, if they wanted it for some reason, if there was an abuse situation and they felt they don't want their dad's name or mom's name, you know, they want that clean break. But it hasn't, in my experience, that hasn't been the case.
Wow. Interesting. There's also a concept called safe haven, where a birth mom takes the newborn to a fire station or other designated place. Could be a hospital. Does that happen here very often?
I haven't seen it happen very often, even statewide, but I do know there are safe haven placements and stuff. And honestly, you know, when you see them nationwide news, I kind of always cringe a little bit, because it's like that kid's story is being told without their permission going forward. Mm-hmm. And I get it. You know, they say, oh, the firefighter that found the safe haven baby adopted. Well, that's great, but like that child never had a chance to decide if that story should be public.
Yeah, that's true.
But I do think that's great, because the alternate is sometimes for whatever family dynamics, religious dynamics, people hide the fact that maybe a younger person has a baby that can't tell their family about it. So they do something that could harm the child or leave it somewhere where it's not going to be cared for. So I really do encourage that the safe haven things exist, but it's definitely I do think the publicizing of the story is kind of hard too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've heard stories about babies put in trash cans or left in, you know, hospital rooms, and the mom just signs herself out. Or
I think one of the things I'm hearing here is that adoption is a viable, healthy option for a baby, a brand new, or even young children who are in foster care for too long, things like that. And it gives options that are healthy for the child. We want every child to have a chance, and adoption is such a wonderful option to keep that child moving forward in their personal life. You know, it's kind of destiny-wise.
Well, and it's great for the child, but it's also great for the adoptive family. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing. It's, you know, it's my kids are amazing, and I'm so thankful that they're in my life, and I don't discredit that they had to go through something and a huge loss to be part of our family, but I'm still grateful for them. And so it's not just great for the kids. I think it's great for the whole family.
One of the things I know to be true is that people who adopt typically do because they want to be parents and they want to have a family. I had a friend that was a birth mother, and when she met the way later, met the parents that took her child in, the parents were so grateful to her for giving birth to that child for them. Mm-hmm. They felt like family. And that's an element that we don't always think about. We think about the child, but for those parents, they've got to become parents.
Well, and one of the symbols for adoption is a triangle, and it represents the child, the birth mom, and the birth family and the adoptive family. And that's kind of because it's three sides to that child's identity.
Very interesting. Do you ever hear stories of where the siblings are not adopted together? I mean, I think your children were so fortunate that they were adopted together. If you're not adopted together, that seems like, again, that adds more psychological stress on you.
And I agree to some degree, but I also understand dynamics. So children through trauma sometimes have poor relationships with their siblings because one has been in the position to be a parent, or one has been abusive to another child because they're emulating their parents. So sometimes for the health and safety of the children, they are split apart. I think it's great when it's done the right way, where they still have communication that's healthy for the children and all that entails. But sometimes it is unfortunate, especially when there's a large age gap. Mm-hmm. You might have it where, you know, the adoptive family only wants a certain age group and there's a much older sibling. And so that's always very hard, especially if that older sibling has helped raise the younger siblings. But I do think they do try and keep, that is the priority, is to keep siblings together. Just sometimes it's just impossible based on a large group of siblings or, you know, behaviors that might not be safe for the children.
Okay. We've talked a lot about domestic adoptions. I'm going to change gears a bit to international. Previously, China and Russia were such common countries where Americans adopted children, but those countries have closed, and currently, at least one study I read was that the most common country now is Colombia, India, South Korea, Bulgaria, and Ukraine. And adoptive families and pregnant females will come from different socioeconomic levels, too. So, basically, on the foreign adoptions, again, we often would be brought a history, and you don't know if the orphanage is giving the real history, but you're given the history of the child, the medical history, and then it's not up to us to decide, but it's up to us to help the parents decide, because they'll bring it, the form to us, the information, the medical history, and then, you know, they're concerned if the child has any heart problems. Is the heart problem really serious, or is it just being magnified in what they're reading? So we would get involved with these international adoptions, and there's also some big cities have actual adoption clinics where the whole medical history, when the child gets there, a really thorough physical exam, and then they have the specialists such as psych and occupational therapy and physical therapy and speech to help them. Of course, we go over their immunization records and their height and weight. But those children, and even and domestic children, certainly have problems. We were talking more about how they need such psychological support. You actually mentioned the attachment bonding disorder that I was going to bring up. And mm-hmm. we've seen a lot of, not a lot, but in our practice, the parents would adopt a child from Romania or Russia, and they would think, okay, or China or South Korea or anywhere, basically, the South American countries, and think, I'm going to be the savior. They're going to just love it here. We're going to really protect them, and they're going to be so good. because they're here and then the child isn't. It could be that they just emotionally can't tolerate being in the American home or the home that they were where they are now, or that the parents are disappointed because they're not the student that they thought they would be, that all, you know, that they would be much, much do better in the American school, and then we end up deciding that they might have fetal alcohol syndrome. So those are all different complications, and a lot of parents would want us to do. One parent came, well, can you do a functional MRI? Well, that was back in the 90s when functional MRIs didn't exist, but you know, they had read some study, again, that it was at some research center, they were doing them on a few patients and trying to develop it to be a test that would be offered to people. So what if you've seen people with the attachment bonding disorder, how do they get help here?
Well, I'm going to go back a little bit and just go into attachment disorder in general. I'm not obviously a medical professional, but I take a lot of training on attachment. And I would say just in a general basis, so many people out there don't know that the first 2 years are critical for building attachment, that the child learns they can trust a caregiver and that their needs are met. And a lot of these foreign adoptions, if they stem from an orphanage, their needs may not have been met. So while the child may come up as one of those things where they are able to look like they're excited and engaged with the family, they may have attachment disorder and they're going to have trust issues. And so that some of those things just don't come out till they're older.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. We do have children who have had been in a failed adoption that do have attachment disorder, or those in foster care. And the difference being foreign born, there's not a lot of resources other than your own medical insurance. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you adopt from the foster care system, you have the benefit of typically adoption subsidies as well as Medicaid to help fund all of those, to try and help with the behaviors, getting them the necessary supports. Maybe they need medications. And there's a lot more help for domestic adoptions that were out of the foster care system, whereas they still may have attachment disorder because they may have had a tough beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that they're without hope. It just means you have to learn to parent differently.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand. And you mentioned the savior complex and stuff. Yeah. And that's one thing you can't go into adoption thinking that it's for the benefit of the kids. It has to be a mutual relationship. It has to be they're giving you as much as you're giving them. And you should never be expecting them to be grateful, because they did have to lose something to gain, be part of your family. Yes. And you can't let that part of it out of your mind. And so I do think that attachment disorders are prevalent at times, but I also think that sometimes parenting's hard, whether it's adoption or not. And parenting teenagers is always very hard.
Yeah, that's so very true. And then I listed drug withdrawal, but that's primarily in those foster moms who are taking the baby right out of the nursery.
Mm-hmm.
The drug withdrawal can be quite stressful on mm-hmm. them.
Yep.
Any topic you think we've missed, Susie or Katie?
Well, one of the things, and I think you've alluded to it quite a bit, but once the child is, say, birth adoption,
mm-hmm.
and the child's family decides to tell them that they were adopted, maybe all along, there's great stories, there's great ways to do that, but the child will have a moment of pause at some point in time in their life. How much psychological social work support is there for the families, the parents, and the child as they move forward through their family life to understand that aspect?
I think it's hard to say, to speak globally on that. I will say, you know, counseling is always helpful. Having a counselor that understands the adoption is important. But there's a lot of adoption support groups, both online and local. And if you're a foster parent, there's foster support groups people can attend. And, you know, sometimes you'll struggle with a behavior. Is it their personality? Is it a teenage hormone? Or is it trauma? And it's not always clear. And so that's why having mental health is always super important from the beginning. If you see any issues coming up, is, you know, they might not feel comfortable explaining why they're struggling, because maybe it could hurt the adoptive family, you know, feelings. Maybe they're struggling with that. And so mental health is critical in that, but it's finding the right support services. And sometimes people are ready at certain times and finding just the best case scenario. But as like a state program or anything like that, it's hard. And I will say private adoptions are going to be your hardest ones because there is no subsidy for extra care. There is not always guaranteed Medicaid, and your private insurance may be difficult. So those, I think, come up a lot more in those kind of placements is when people do international private adoption, they're taking
pay.
A risk.
Yeah, I mean, they pay, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know.
They had to pay a lot to do the adoption, and that's one thing. I'll just throw this out here for those interested in foster to adopt placements. You do not pay. The state does pay your legal fees to complete the adoption.
Yeah.
So there's also usually, if the children meet certain criteria, there's adoption subsidies to make sure that they have the best quality life.
If someone comes to you, a family, and they feel like they need more support, as we were just talking, you mentioned support groups. Do lawyers and attorneys have lists of reference lists,
counselors,
support groups? I don't have a list, but I work with a lot of counselors through my legal practice, so I know people who work great with certain age groups and people that, you know, that have a connection. Mm-hmm. Bonner County is small enough, I don't have a list, but I know. Mm-hmm. But I always tell people to check with the department, because the Department of Health and Welfare does have a lot of resources that they can send you to. And when they're in foster care, they'll help structure all those services, and then you can hopefully continue them on after the adoption. But those outside of that, and I follow a lot of adoption groups online, and there's a lot of resources. And, you know, people are hard workers when they do this. They try and find the best for their family. So sometimes the legwork's been done for you. You just have to connect with the right person.
So like we had it too, like a list in our mind or written down that, you know, if someone was a psychologist I knew was really interested and good at working with attachment disorder, that if I felt that's what the family was having, that's where I would send them to. If the child was having learning problems at school, you'd send them to maybe a different psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
And the family, you know, how the family, basically their interactions were going. If that was going well, or if that was where it was really the behavior problem that the child was having. So, okay. Basically the amount of money, the people that do foreign adoptions, they actually even go over, you know, fly to a certain country and then pay a lot of money. So, Katie, thank you so much for being here with us today to discuss National Adoption Month. I really appreciate your willingness to discuss both your experience and insight as an attorney and as an adoptive parent. A couple of other dates important in November: Veterans Day on November 11th. We thank all of our veterans for their service. And World Kindness Day on November 13th. That's actually a week before National Adoption Day, so it really funnels into each other. But it's so nice that so many schools now feature Kindness Day and T-shirts or posters or programs on kindness. And thank you all for listening to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. Please do remember, this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. Please tune in next month on December 2nd when we'll be discussing toy safety in preparation for the holiday gift-giving season. This is 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho.